you guys for braving the storm, although it doesn't look so bad out there right now. It's still a little windy, but not quite as ominous as it was this morning. So thanks for braving the storm to come out and hear me. So today I want to talk a little bit about what my group does, both sort of going back to some of the data that Ari alluded to earlier, so some of the work we've done, and also some of the new stuff that we're working on and getting started here in Konstanz. I'm going to start by admitting something, which is that I'm an anthropologist by training. I'm not actually a biologist or a behavioral ecologist. And what that means is that the perspective that I bring to studying animals is shaped by that training. And I wanted to start with this picture, both because it was one of the cooler emails that I've ever gotten. I got this, an email from an art historian who had found this painting in Congo, in archives. And it came from a church and a manuscript that was put together by one of the early missionaries to the DRC, and reporting a lot of the natural history observations that he made in his time in this totally new place for him in the world. And one of the things I think is true is that as animal behavior researchers, or as people interested in how animal societies work, we often see the world through our own eyes. So this priest had likely observed a group of monkeys mobbing a leopard, and had looked at their behavior, their coordination in this collective defense, collective attack against this leopard. And probably anthropomorphized. I don't think monkeys were really holding hands and forming a ring around this leopard. But we interpret the world that we see through our own cultures and our own societies. And I think that part of what I want to do and part of what we are doing in our group is trying to understand not only how our own culture shapes how we see the cultures of other animals, the societies of other animals, but also what we can learn about who we are as a species from knowing more about how the societies of animals in general emerge and function. So human uniqueness, what makes us such an unusual species, what makes us stand out from the other animals that we share this planet with, it doesn't lie so much in the traits or characteristics of individuals per se. Instead, it really emerges in what happens when groups of people come together and interact, like is going to be happening, I hear, next week in Konstanz. Humans are a hypersocial species, and we are almost uniquely dependent on interactions with and support from our social groups to survive and reproduce. And you know, we're a species that is unusually reliant on our collective adaptations. From the languages that create shared meaning, that we all speak and use to create shared meaning, to the cumulative nature of our cultures, the fact that we can go to space even though no single individual knows all of the parts of how to do that, and in fact, no single generation can develop from scratch what it takes in order to send a man to space. It's also sort of obvious in the large-scale cooperation that underlies all of humans' greatest achievements. We are inherently a highly and uniquely social species. However, in that reliance on our social connections, we're far from alone. Repeatedly over evolutionary history, we've seen transitions from solitary lifestyles into group living, and from loose organizations into tightly integrated, highly differentiated societies. And while primates in general, and humans in particular, have made complex social lifestyles a corner species of our adaptation, all highly social species live their lives embedded in social networks, multifaceted connections that evolve over time. And these connections are really fundamental to the survival and reproduction of all of these species. In fact, highly social species, we all live in what is functionally a collective ecology. The interactions with our group mates creates much of the environment that we live in that we inhabit, and which we're evolving in. So when I say collective ecology, what am I talking about? Well, it's the fact that in stable group living animals, yes, you live in a habitat that's shaping the distribution of resources that are available to you, the dangers like predation that you are challenged with. But you're also faced with a whole social environment, a social ecology that you're having to navigate. So we're interested at the most fundamental level in why we see differences in individual behavior. Why are these males busy fighting, whereas this guy's consorting a female? What is it in how individuals react to the same stimuli that creates differences? To what degree is that genetic predisposition versus context-dependent behavioral plasticity? One of the things that maybe differentiates us a little bit from what's already going on in the cluster, and one of the things I think makes primate studies and the studies of complex animal societies in general an interesting tie to the human sciences, is the fact that we're specifically interested in how relationships amongst interacting units, the relationships amongst groupmates, influence both the decisions of individuals and the behavior of the group as a whole. So the prior history of these two individuals will impact what happens later in the day, later in the week, later in the year. And you can create sort of via that history, that rich history of interactions amongst the same animals, cultures. So for example, a well-known example of this is in a group of baboons, which due to an unusual and probably one-off sort of event, nothing you could ever replicate very easily, had mass mortality amongst the males, which totally, in the end, reshaped the culture of that group and introduced what was been titled a Pacific culture amongst this group of baboons. Levels of aggression, even 10 years later, were dramatically below what had been observed in the group before. And so there seems to be the potential for cultures within social groups to emerge, behavioral cultures, social cultures. And so to really understand these collective ecologies and how they're shaping the evolutionary milieus that individuals in these groups are having to navigate. These questions are key to understanding how we have, for example, chimpanzees whose entire social organization is dominated by strict dominance hierarchies, aggressive interactions both between males within the group, but particularly male directed towards female aggression in the mating context, but also has very highly cooperative male relationships in the context of territorial defense and intergroup aggression. In contrast to their closest relatives, the bonobos, the pygmy chimpanzees, which live in much more Pacific, female-dominated societies, where you don't see the same types or levels of aggression, and where, in contrast to the male-dominated chimpanzee, in bonobos you have a female-dominated society. Similarly, if we want to understand, we're interested in understanding questions like why Philostomus bats in Jamaica live in large groups that share information and seem to forage collectively on nectar-producing trees or flower-producing trees and the nectar that they provide, whereas the same species, if you travel down to Bolivia, doesn't seem to share information or rely on that social component of their foraging, and seem to have, in general, a totally different social structure. So what causes that variation that we see? So today what I want to do is take you guys on a little tour around the world. We're going to touch briefly on three main projects that we're working on in my group right now. The first of which is focused on understanding how the structure of social connections within groups shapes how groups make decisions and what the types of decisions that they make. Focusing on baboons. And baboons are of particular interest as a study taxa. We're going to come back to this in a minute, because they have tremendous variation and are also incredibly well studied. We know a tremendous amount about their social structure, and this allows us to dig deeper into understanding how the types of interactions and relationships they form shape group decisions. I'm then going to take you over to the other side of the world to talk a little bit about culture and tool use, and the role that plays in primate and non-human animal societies generally, and also the ways in which behavioral variation across populations is a really important but difficult to study aspect. And finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the comparative work we're doing, trying to understand the cognition that underlies foraging strategies in a guild of neotropical primates. So coming back to baboons, I said earlier that baboons are an interesting study species. And in part, you could in fact think of them almost as a model species for understanding animal societies in their natural ecologies. And this is because baboons have been the subject of some of the longest field studies of wild animal behavior. So the Amboseli Baboon Project has been running 40 years. There are numerous other long-term studies which have really started to, which have given us a picture of the social world that baboons inhabit that's really unique. So baboons live their lives in a society that's structured by strongly by dominance relationships. So if you go out to a baboon and watch a baboon group, you're gonna see a lot of aggressive interactions. You're gonna see males beating up on females, beating up on each other, beating up on the new guy who just tried to join the group. Aggressive interactions are a major component of their daily lives, and they live in these very strictly linear dominance hierarchies. So there's an alpha male, a beta male, and you can rank all the way down to the dude who's getting beat up by everybody. Similarly, there's within the female lineages, there's also a dominance hierarchy. But interestingly, they're formed in totally different ways. So male baboons are the dispersing sex. When they enter a new group, they basically have to try to fight their way up the hierarchy. They enter at the bottom, mostly, and try to gain dominance via these aggressive interactions with other group mates. In contrast, baboon females they basically inherit their dominance rank. So you have matrilines of females, and because mothers support their youngest offspring, what that means is you have reverse ascendancy. So basically the dominant female in a group, it's her youngest daughter who ranks directly below her, and second youngest after that, and third youngest after that. But females don't have to fight for their dominance. It's all sort of encoded via that maternal support. The other thing you'll notice if you visit a baboon troop is the amount of time these guys dedicate towards maintaining their social relationships. You guys think you spend a lot of time on the phone with friends, or that your teenage daughters spend a lot of time on the phone with friends, going out to the bars, drinking with your buddies. These guys spend tremendous amounts of their day doing nothing, sitting around, grooming, being groomed, and generally investing in social partnerships. And I think one of the really interesting things that's emerging from this long-term data on baboons is that this investment really has payoffs that you can track both at the physiological level and even at sort of showing the evolutionary repercussions of these investment. So if you're a female baboon, there sort of seem to be two styles of social bonds. There are females who invest heavily in a few tight social partners. They spend a lot of time grooming a few close, and I'm gonna say it, I'm sorry, Damien, friends. I get in trouble for using that word, but consider it a shorthand. And you have females who are more promiscuous about their social bonds, who are grooming kind of everybody. And what's interesting is that females who invest heavily in a few preferred social partners have lower stress hormone levels. They have better infant survival to age one and to reproductive maturity, and they have higher reproductive rates overall. You also see an impact on these females when one of their close social partners dies, in that their these relationships really do matter. When one of your friends dies, we can track females' stress hormones spiking and sort of increased sort of social promiscuity as she reestablishes new and expands her social network and creating new social connections. It's not just females that this matters for. Males also rely heavily on these social connections. So peripheral males who aren't tightly involved in a male-female grooming relationship, who don't have a preferred female grooming partner, tend to be more spatially peripheral, are more socially peripheral, have higher stress hormones, and also are more likely to die. Die at an earlier age or for any particular within any given increment of time. And these relationships for males are also important because forming close grooming relationships with the female translates directly into reproductive access. So these friendships is an alternate pathway to reproductive success from dominance. You don't have to be a dominant guy. This is if you are not dominant, having a close female partner is another way of gaining reproductive access. So baboon societies are interesting not just because of the strength of these social connections and the ways in which they're impacting both how baboons spend time and these issues of stress and reproduction. They're also shaping the baboon's ecology because baboon troops move as a single unit across the landscape. It's not a fission-fusion society where at any point in time individuals are making decisions about, nah, the group's going that way, I feel like bananas today, I'm going over there. No, this group moves as a single unit across the landscape, and what that means is that they're constantly having to reach consensus about where to go and what to do. They're constantly having to overcome conflicts of interest because, as you can see in this picture, baboon troops are quite heterogeneous. Males are about twice as big as females. You've got a whole range of subadult and juvenile individuals, females who are lactating or carrying infants. All of these individual level differences on top of the social relationships, what that ends up meaning is that what is the best thing for any particular individual at any particular moment in time is likely different from what other members of their troop want to do. And what this means is groups have to have mechanisms for reaching decisions. And these decisions have important implications because where you're gonna eat, what you're gonna eat, when you're gonna rest are all dependent on what the group decides, not your own individual. You can't make an individual decision that's gonna stick for the group necessarily. So when we think about animal decision making, we can think of it as a continuum from fully unshared, where on one end of a spectrum, where a single decider has all of the power, all the way through to an equally shared system where everyone votes and everyone's voice counts equally. And of course, in reality, there's a tremendous, this is a spectrum, this is a continuum, and there's probably a whole lot of harder to define places along the spectrum where real animal societies fall. And so groups, in the choice of making these decisions, are negotiating both power differentials that result from these dominance hierarchies, social differentials that result from more and less tightly socially integrated individuals, differences in physiological need, differences in locomotor capacity. And one of the real challenges that I think is really exciting about being here at Konstanz with Ian's group and the potential to work with so many of the groups here who are working on these questions, up until now, it's been fundamentally impossible to ask questions like how do groups decide, because the ways in which we traditionally study animal behavior in the wild were simply not conducive to understanding the context-dependent nature of individual decisions. So the fact that what I'm choosing to do now is not just dependent on what you're doing, but is dependent also on what everybody around you is doing. When we watch animals in the wild, when we study species like primates in the wild, usually what we're doing is a focal individual follow, where we're watching a single individual and recording what they do across a period of time. And because we're focused on this individual, we see who she interacts with, but we are missing what's going on the other side of the group. We're missing much of the social world that is surrounding her and that she's part of. And these methods make it really difficult to answer questions about group-level phenomenon like decision-making. So current methods have been a real impediment to asking questions in the wild about how complex societies like these function. And so three of the things that we're working on in my group right now are developing measurement technologies that will allow us to fundamentally observe, map, monitor groups as they interact with one another within their within the ecological and evolutionarily relevant habitats where these decision-making processes evolved. We're interested in developing the analytical tools that can take the data, the types of data that emerge, to yield insight into who has influence. And finally, we're interested in developing experimental frameworks. And the reason that these three things together are so important, and what I'm gonna tell you about today is a single group of baboons, but ultimately what we're trying to do is create a framework and a tool set that could be exported across populations or across groups of the same species living in a single population, across populations living in different ecologies, and across species to tease apart how particular facets of a group's structure, of a group of the social environment that a group lives in, how that impacts their ability and how they make decisions. And of course, all of this is tremendously benefited from the fact that we're all cell phone addicts, which has driven both a reduction in the size, the cost, and improvements in the battery performance of all kinds of microelectronics that provide us with new windows into what's going on in these animals' lives. So we don't actually strap a cell phone onto baboons, although reasonably close. By using high-resolution telemetry collars, we can track movement of entire groups of animals in very high resolution. So this is a troop of baboons. This is the data that Ari was talking about. And so animals are colored according to their age, sex, class. Red are adult females, orange are subadult females, dark blue are adult males, light blue are subadult males. And what we're about to see here is as they move across this landscape, there's a difference of opinion within the group about which way to move around this thicket area. So part of the group wants to go right, part of the group wants to go left, and they kind of end up at a deadlock here. And eventually what's going to happen is that one of the subgroups is going to give in and sort of follow around the right side of this area. So this is a purely observational way of looking at real social groups in their natural habitat facing the kinds of choices that they're facing on a day-to-day basis. This is a data set that I've worked largely, although not entirely, with Ari Stramberger-Peshkin and Damien Farin on, because it's been a challenge. So as Ari said, we met in 2012, and this is a data set we're still working on. The tools to analyze these kinds of data are basically, you have to sort of, you're making it up as you go, is a fair way of saying it. And so digging into how you extract meaning from these hundreds of thousands to millions of GPS data points to understand something about what's driving the individuals who are interacting here is a challenge. So through long conversations, we came up with a really simple way of looking at these data. Basically looking at, if I move away from you, do you follow me? In which case I've pulled you. Or if I move away and you don't follow, do I come back? In which case it's a failed pull or an anchor. And so looking at these sorts of dyadic, it's basically just looking at the relative distances between individuals over time. And from that we're able to look at what are the characteristics of individuals who are successfully able to influence their group members. Now you might, given what I've told you about the importance of dominance in baboon groups, dominant individuals get the best food places, the best mating opportunities, you might expect dominant individuals to also dominate the decision-making process. And interestingly, that was one of the first things we looked at. So if you're sitting around and you've got individuals from your group pulling in two directions, who do you follow? Well, it turns out that high rank, you don't follow the dominant guy. High rank is actually not, surprisingly to us, was not related to how successful individuals were at pulling their group mates. So high rank doesn't seem to afford influence in this context in baboon societies. What seems to matter is how you move. So moving in relatively, at a relatively consistent and fast rate with very high path directedness, basically walking straight and consistently and pretty fast, is the way to recruit others to follow you. And when you have sort of differences of opinion within the group and different numbers of individuals pulling in opposite directions, what we find is the really strong evidence, not for a despotic process, instead for a democratic process. It's basically majority rule. You go with whichever direction more of your group mates seem to favor. So this was surprising to us on one level, in the sense that I think anyone who'd studied baboons would have assumed that this sort of pervasive importance of dominance would have extended to leadership in these contexts. It's perhaps not at all surprising to people like Ian, who studies collective systems more generally. And in a wide variety of collective systems, it's been shown that this sort of democratic decision-making both is easier to evolve and more robust in a number of ways, or is robust in a number of ways. And so I think that part of what this work, the challenge that this work poses, is to understand, despite all of these power asymmetries, despite the social connections that we would expect to influence strongly who you want to be with and who you want to spend your time near, we see very similar patterns to what is seen in sort of anonymous systems of where you don't expect and you don't rely on any of those inter-individual bonds or connections. So we were also interested, of course, in not only how the social environment that individuals are moving within, but also the habitat that they're moving within, how that shapes these kinds of decisions. And so by using a drone, we were able to map at very high resolution the landscape that these animals were walking across. And what you're seeing here is the same group of baboons traveling up a hill through a bushy habitat. And lines connect individuals who have direct sight lines to one another, who can see, in theory, could see one another as they move through this landscape. And part of what this exercise of mapping the landscape demonstrated is that baboons spend much of their time in highly visually disrupted habitats where they can't see most of their group members at all. And where coordination likely poses important challenges. They, of course, have acoustic signals that they're using, and that's something that we're working on at the moment, but don't really haven't gotten to the point of having actual products yet to understand how the acoustic communication is impacting their decision making. But this poses a whole range of interesting challenges and suggests that baboon groups illustrates how baboon groups are having to make decisions in a whole range of contexts which pose different obstacles to reaching consensus. And so to me, one of the most interesting things that came out of this is actually hidden in the supplemental methods, I think, because I think I didn't realize until after we'd published the paper that I thought this was actually the coolest thing to come out of the whole exercise. But I get excited about this. So this is basically showing the same pattern we saw before, the same majority rule, but showing that where a decision is being made impacts the process that the group is using to make that decision. So baboons like walking on roads. That's perhaps not surprising. Baboons are primates, and like us, they are lazy. Roads are relatively flat. They're probably easy to travel along, and so they use them extensively in their habitat. If a road's there, baboons like to walk on it. Perhaps because they're easy to walk on, what this means is that if you're off the road and trying to pull your group on the road, no problem. But if the group is on the road and you're trying to pull the group off the road, it's no longer a simple majority rule. It actually takes a supermajority to get the group to leave the road. It's a harder challenge. There's more sort of friction to that decision. And I think that what this illustrates is that the decision-making processes and the rules that are going on that underlie group decisions are likely plastic. And how they're plastic, I think, is part of what we're really excited about trying to figure out in the next years. So rules are context dependent, I said that. One of the real limitations and problems that we've faced is that we have no idea what is going on in this baboon's head. From the data that we have really good information on where he is, what he's doing, who's around him, what his environment is like. But how all of that is being integrated with his own individual motivations, physiological parameters, it's a total black box for us. And that poses a real problem. And so what we've been working on, an idea that originated with Damien Farine, but that we've continued with, is using an experimental paradigm to try to sort of get us out of this problem of the fact that we don't know what's going on in these animals' heads. So we've been developing pit tag controlled feeders. So basically feeders that can either allow access or deny access, or allow particular types of access or rates of access, depending on the individual identity of the animals that we're studying. And then using these to set up choice experiments. Do I go left to feeding patch A or right to feeding patch B? So Roy Harrell, who's a postdoc who is in my lab, came from California in September, has been sort of pushing this forward at our research site in Impala. And what you're seeing here is a baboon troop's sort of first interaction with these feeders. And one of the interesting things, I think, to me, was how quickly they figured it out. It didn't take them long to learn that they can reach through the hole in these things and access food. So they'll sit there, reach through the door. It's basically like a cat door, a pet cat door that unlocks when you open it. They also get really pissed off when they get locked out. So we're gonna have to find better ways of locking them down. But what we can use these feeders to do then is to create, is to manipulate individual motivation and create conflicts of interest within groups about where individuals want to go. And the key part here is that we know what those motivations are because we've created them. So all of a sudden, it's a way to gain access to that black box that is the animal's head. And so Roy has done the first set of experiments. So again, red-colored individuals, we're tracking individuals with GPS collars. This is their sleep site. Red individuals get food over here. Blue individuals get food over here. And so we can look at not only, so we know where individuals want to go, and we can look at both who is leading, how they are leading, what they're able to do in order to recruit followers to their direction of choice, and in what context they're able to do that. And what's nice about this experimental layout is that we have not just the choice of do they go left or right first, but then how long do they stay here before visiting the other site. Now I want to bring us back to this graph. The strongest impact that we found, and as I said, this surprised us, on how successful an individual was at pulling other groupmates, at recruiting other groupmates to move, was how they walked. Steady, straight direction, intermediate to high speed. Now, there are a bunch of reasons that this might be true, that this might be an effective behavioral strategy for recruiting followers. One of which, you know, is that maybe this is just a really, this is a much more visible signal. Maybe it's more obvious. Baboons mill around a lot when they're searching for food. They have highly circuitous routes when they're foraging. And maybe there's something about moving off in a straight line that catches others' attention. Another possibility, however, is that what's going on is that this kind of movement is actually a signal either of information or of motivation. If you know where you want to go, you don't necessarily futz around, you just move off. So it's potentially a signal of either information or motivation. And so just teasing into some of the first results from this, we can look at this in this data. We can ask the question, are red individuals pulling in this way, moving in a straighter, faster manner in the period when they're motivated to travel over here versus in the training period when they have no particular preference at all? When they're just learning to use the feeders, and it doesn't matter whether they go left or right. And in fact, that's what we find. So basically, these light blue cases versus the dark blue cases are when individuals are pulling, this is basically the motivated individuals pulling, and they're pulling straighter and faster than individuals than those same individuals before they had that motivation to travel in the direction. So it suggests that movement is in some ways is reflecting some aspect of the individual's motivation that is perhaps being picked up on by its groupmates in their decision to follow. So with this toolkit, what we're eventually aiming to be able to do is look at not just a single group in a single site, but look at groups that vary. So groups that vary in our same ecosystem in terms of size. So baboons are really interesting. They can live in groups of 10 up to groups of 150. Presumably the kinds of challenges that are raised by coordinating a group of 150 are different, fundamentally different than what's involved in coordinating a group of 10. Similarly, they live in habitats that range from completely open savanna where visibility is really good, through to forest living species who are having to deal with highly visually disrupted and probably acoustically disrupted habitats, both of which are likely to pose significant challenges to coordination. And finally, they're interesting on a third dimension, which is that baboons aren't just baboons. They all look kind of the same, but there are actually a number of species of baboons, all of which have slightly different social structures that they're living in. From sort of much more, so I told you that the baboons I study are quite, the dominance plays an important role. Well, in the grand scheme of baboon social systems, all of baboons are really nice. There's actually much less aggression in their societies. The dominance relationships are less steep than, for example, Chacma baboons in South Africa. And compared to Hamadryas baboons, it's a whole different world. So we have a range of different kinds of societies that baboons form, which we hope to be able to sort of assay via conducting the same kinds of experiments across different populations. So we're going to move from Kenya to Panama, largely, Panama and Central South America, and talk a little bit about another aspect of our work, which is focused on trying to understand how behavioral traditions emerge, how they persist in populations, and why you have some populations and that use, for example, tools, whereas others of the same species nearby, other groups nearby, don't, and why we have differences in across both at the population level, but also at the interspecies level. So capuchins are really interesting, a really interesting set of species, in part because they have really big brains. So we're humans. One of the defining characteristics of humans over our evolutionary trajectory is this massive increase in brain size that has happened, despite the significant costs of having a big brain. Brain tissue is really costly, energetically speaking. But it also allows us to do really a variety of interesting things, we think. Capuchins are also a highly encephalized species. So they have a brain to body size ratio that is bigger than, I think, almost any other primate except us, maybe chimpanzees, but they're about comparable to chimpanzees. And they're interesting because there are two main types of capuchins, robust capuchins, which live primarily in South America, many of whom use stone tools as a key part of their sort of ecological niche. They crack open hard nuts to access this really high quality resource inside. In contrast, these guys, which are part of the Cebus capuchins, the grass isle capuchins, they have all the pieces. So they have big brains too. They do cultural traditions. So what you're seeing here is one of the weirder ones. This particular population has developed an eye-poking tradition. We think it's a bond-testing thing. They will sit next to a close social grooming partner and insert their finger all the way up to the second knuckle in the eye socket and just sit there for like 30 minutes. Nobody knows why they do this. There are lots of reasons to not do it. There's not really an obvious good reason to do it. But what's interesting in this particular population is they've documented the spread of this. So individuals who've left one group and taken this tradition to other groups, to other nearby groups when they moved. But so this is interesting, because this suggests social learning. This suggests the ability to spread culturally innovated innovations. But weirdly, despite all of this, they were not known tool users until just recently. So we actually, this is probably the only time I'm gonna get to discover something like totally new, which is really exciting. Working with my group, we've been spending time out on this remote archipelago in Panama where we had heard rumors that the capuchins were using stone tools to open nuts. And in fact, yes, they do. They do it in a habitual way. It's extremely common. Basically, every day at these sites along the beach where we've set camera traps, we get capuchins coming to these sites, transporting nuts, transporting the tools, and using them to open. It's largely, this thing that he's pounding there now, is it's a sea almond. It's a likely an invasive species that washed over from, or natural invasive species washed over from Asia. Very high quality nut, high caloric density food that they are unable to open without the use of a stone tool. So they can't access this food source without the stone tool. They also use these two, they have also sort of generalized, they use these tools to open a bunch of other things as well, including crabs and hermit crabs. But these nuts are the only one that they require the stone tool to open. And so this raises really, to me, some really interesting questions. Why was this genus thought to be non-tool using? Well, it's incredibly well studied. There are 5 30-plus year studies of Cebus species out there. If these guys were doing it at these other study sites, we would know about it. There may be other populations where this exists, but it's incredibly unusual that a species that has all the pieces, this is the first time that we've seen them actually putting those pieces together to use stone tools to access new foods. My graduate student Claudio and my postdoc Brendan have been doing yeoman's work out on these islands. So the Coiba Archipelago is down here off the coast of Panama. It's a set of islands that is also, in addition to being a home of stone tool using monkeys, it's also a major stopover point of drugs coming up from Colombia to the United States. So it has some challenges for working there, which is part of the reason that we were working almost entirely remotely. So we're working almost entirely with camera traps because it's just not safe to be out on these islands for long periods of time. So there are 3 main islands that have capuchins. Coiba itself, which was a penal colony. It's the only reason there's that much tropical dry forest left. It's the biggest chunk of Pacific dry forest left in the entire Central America because it was a penal colony until about 10 years ago. So there are capuchins on Coiba, on the small island of Coibita, and on Jicarón. And so we've been traveling out there to basically document this tradition, try to understand the natural history of what's going on here and why this one island, this one population, not only innovated this behavior, but then why it's persisted for as long as it has. When you go out to these sites, we're actually working with a suite of archaeologists because when you go out to these sites, this isn't a new thing. We know from direct observation it's been going on for at least 10 years, but you look at the accumulation of these shells, and it's been going on for much, much, much longer than that. So what's going on? Why does we would all assume is an advantageous behavioral adaptation. Tool use allows them to access resources that they wouldn't be able to access otherwise, resources that are available to other capuchins and not used. Why tool use in this population? Well, we're starting to tease apart some of the answers. We think that at least part of it is related to the fact that Coiban capuchins are highly terrestrial. There are no ocelots or big cats of any kind, ocelots, jaguar, puma. There are none of them on this entire archipelago. And what this means, we think, is that explains why we see capuchins doing things that capuchins don't do in other forests. They travel on the ground, they sleep on the ground, they play on the ground, they nap and groom on the ground. They've moved out of a largely arboreal ecosystem into an arboreal and terrestrial one. And that probably makes it easier to use stone tools if you're not constantly, if they are A, right there, and B, after you've hauled it up into a tree, you hit something, it falls to the ground. It's probably not an easy behavior to develop in the trees. This island system is also has features of all island systems. So reduced species richness as a function of how big the islands are, and that just generally islands are prone to disturbance. You have lots of edge effects that reduce food availability. And finally, incredibly high population density. We don't know why the capuchins are so dense on this island system, but they are. There are also 2 main questions that we're really totally puzzled by. We've been camera trapping out there for 3 years, and tool use is entirely restricted to this one stretch of beach, as far as we can tell, on Jicarón, and only males do it. Now, it isn't a size thing. Tiny males do it, big males do it, but we've never seen a female actually using stone tools. That's both contrary to what we see in most other primates that use tools. So in chimpanzees, females tend to be much more highly adept at stone tool use. It's also weird because if males are doing this, they're also the dispersing sex. We would expect them to have spread it across the entire island itself, but it has somehow remained highly localized. So these are the questions that we're trying to answer via a comparative method of looking at the populations within this archipelago that use stone tools and that don't, comparing them to populations, well-studied populations where we see transmission of lots of behaviors but no use of tools, and finally by comparing them to another site where I work where we see no traditions and no tools, all within the same species. So basically, these guys are highly variable, and I think a comparative perspective is really both what is necessary, but it's also, in a sort of broader sense, what I think the direction our field needs to go. We need to be thinking not just about what particular populations do, but trying to understand that in a broader comparative context of what a species can do across its range. So, finishing up quickly, I wanted to tell you guys one last story, mostly because it's one that I want feedback on. So this is brand new stuff that I don't really have good answers for. But it's being done in conjunction with a team of researchers, and we're broadly interested in comparing the foraging strategies of this guild of neotropical frugivores, who all rely on a very similar resource base. And the story that the sort of relatively new result that I want to tell you guys about actually comes, we started to look at it because of a result from the human mobility literature. So a colleague of mine tracked a whole bunch of Danish undergrads in Copenhagen. And what he found is that these Copenhagen students, Danish students, had what he thinks of, what he calls spatial repertoires. That basically, in a given day, you only go to a very limited number of places. You go home, you go to the bus stop, you go to your grocery store, maybe your favorite restaurant, maybe the gym, school, work. And these repertoires have a very characteristic size. People have approximately the same sized, all the students in a sample had approximately the same sized repertoire. And interestingly, the repertoire updates over time. It's not that you only ever go to the same 7 places, but as you add a new place, an old one drops out the back. So your repertoire size stays the same, even though the composition of that repertoire changes through time. Our collaborators had tied this idea, tied this repertoire size to sort of an idea of like a cognitive limitation. That somehow, like Dunbar's number, there's a pattern where we have a given number of social, close social affiliates. Perhaps there's also some sort of cognitive limitation that shapes our spatial repertoire size. So we decided to take the same methods and look at them across our set of frugivore species that have very different scales of movement, very different social systems, sensory adaptations. And interestingly, what we find is basically the same pattern. Differences in the scale, but the same pattern. So as you increase the number of days that you're looking across, all these species continue to explore. They continue to incorporate new places and to visit new places. That's as you'd expect, I think. Interestingly, when you look at the rate at which humans in the black line incorporate new places, it's much more similar to kinkajous and to coatis than it is to either of the primate species we work with, spider monkeys or capuchins. And interestingly, all of these species have the same consistent repertoire, or have a species-specific repertoire size. So in blue here, spider monkeys visit more places over any given time window. But it stays consistent. And there's quite a bit of species level variation. So spider monkeys have big spatial repertoire systems, humans have small ones, and capuchins have something sort of in the middle. Now the way that I'm thinking about this at the moment is actually not so much as a cognitive limitation, but is instead, so I like to cook. I cook a lot of things. And over time, sort of like at any given time window, if you come to my house, there's sort of I'm cooking from a particular repertoire. Like at any given night, I might choose to, from among say like 7 or 8 things that I'm cooking regularly right now. Doesn't mean I only know how to cook 7 or 8 things, but maybe this is like a shorthand. Basically, you know, as time goes by, I'll remember, oh yeah, I used to cook that thing that I really liked. And so that comes in and then something falls out the back of what I'm doing regularly. I'm thinking that maybe this is sort of like that. It's not that these animals can only remember some limited number of places in their habitat, you know, 30 places in their habitat. It's that It's a shorthand, a way of facilitating their decision-making process by limiting sort of the complexity of the choices that they're making. But anyway, I don't totally know what to make of this result, either the species differences, or just more generally, what the stability in the spatial repertoire size means, and what that's actually telling us about either the animal's cognition or the ecology that's sort of shaping their space use and decision-making processes. But I'm hoping to get to talk to some of you guys about it. So anyway, I'm done. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take questions, and I'm sorry if I ran a little long.
I was wondering, the third one, what defines a place?
Yeah, so basically, the simplified version is it's somewhere where you stay for, that when you visit it, you stay for a while, and it's a place that you return to regularly. And so we took the algorithm that they had developed for these Danish undergrads and ran it over the data set from these four frugivore species. And it's robust. We varied it. So we varied the definition of how long you have to stay there and how often you have to revisit to be considered a place. And that part, at least, that seems robust. We still find these patterns sort of regardless of how we define, like how we tweak those parameters.
Mm-hmm. So spider monkeys are much more specialized in fruit than, say, like koalas are.
Yep.
So I'm curious if that may play a role, that if the spider monkeys have more locations, mm-hmm. they have to go check more of the fig trees and what have you, whereas the koalas can be like, oh, the fig's not fruiting today, so let's
yep.
get a bunch of spiders or something.
So I'm going to answer that. So I forgot to say that one of the reasons that we think that this particular comparison is interesting for this question is that we're focused, it's a project that was designed around a time of year, basically a 2.5 month window, when all four of these species, their diets are dominated by a single tree species that we can map in its entirety. So we've done drone flights and we can map every single Dipteryx tree on this island, so we know where every possible food resource is, and all of these species are eating 80 plus percent of their diet of the single species. So they are about as close as you could get to like relying on the same resource base.
Okay. And then my other question was, you're looking at like 100 days, right?
Yeah, so it's about 100 days in each year.
I'm curious if you expanded it up to 100 days, so whether you get the same spread.
Yep. Space. I think that's a really cool question. We don't have tracking because this data was not collected for this particular question. We have a limitation on the window for this for the data we have currently. One of the things that I'm interested in is there are lots of very, very long-term primate, at least, movement data sets, but also from other species, and I think it'd be really interesting to run this algorithm over species with much longer records where we can look at how long do you see this, do you see it if you run this over hundreds of days of data. In the Danish data, in the human data, you do.
I had a question about the first part, when you had your axis of shared spotting decision making, mm-hmm. and you're referring to animals with very stable groups here, but of course in fission fusion groups, you have the third axis or option of
leave. Yep.
And I guess that's going to make the picture more complex, mm-hmm. but I was wondering if you could kind of speculate as to how you think that affects the ecology.
Yeah. So I think fission fusion groups, and I guess I'm going to say fission-fusion societies to differentiate, like, so you have fission-fusion groups where there's not necessarily, like, membership in a community with sort of any clear in-group, out-group dynamics, and, fish people and bird people can speak to this perhaps better than I can, but my sense is that, like, in these massive starling flocks or these massive schools of fish, the fish don't behave differently towards in-group and out-group fish, in-group and out-group starlings. Maybe that's a simplification that isn't warranted. In contrast to, for example, apparently the guinea fowl, for example, that Damien is working on, the primates that have fission-fusion systems, hyenas, dolphins, where there's a clear in-group, out-group dynamic. And yes, I agree that like when you have when the choice is not just like, when you have the opportunity to either go with the group or to split out on your own or to split into subgroups, all of a sudden those dynamics become both more complex and more interesting, I think, because it adds this additional choice. And I think how these splitting decisions get made along what axes can tell you a lot about what animals care about. in terms of the relative importance of their own internal physiological state, how hungry are you, the importance of the social connections, the importance of information in those systems. So yeah, I think it's really cool, and I think possibly a very, very interesting, fruitful way to go.
I think about the island where you have some of the fruit, some of the breaking behavior, but not elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys mapped the distribution of the trees? They're just everywhere.
The trees are everywhere. The rocks are everywhere. The capuchins are everywhere. Like, there is no, like, it's really hard to prove a negative. So so one of the things is, like, I have to give a caveat to only this one population does it, because actually just recently we've discovered on the Big Island, so the other island, in another highly localized location, we found another group that must be using stone tools because we're finding evidence. And this is non-dispersing. This has to be a totally independent emergence of the behavior. But yeah, one of the things we're struggling with in the system is that it's really hard to prove an ecological negative. So we've done a tremendous amount of survey work, both to map where things are in terms of the resources. So like, is it actually true that any capuchin could do this and they're not? Or is it that, like, in fact, the basic materials they would need to do this are missing? There's an ecological limitation. But then also this question of, from all the surveying we've done, it seems like the behavior is incredibly prevalent along this one stretch of beach and it is nowhere else. But 2.5 years in, we did find a new population in a totally different area that's doing it in a much more limited sense. Like, they're not, in the main spot, they're these set of anvils that they come back to on a daily basis. What we're seeing in this other site is much more transient in stream beds. So yeah, it's sort of a very different way of doing science, because you're very limited in terms of what you can know and what conclusions you can draw, but it's also fun. Mm-hmm. Well, so it's not only, they have a few spots that they use very heavily and very repeatedly, but they also use a lot of other spots as well. So we don't think that the anvils are a limitation, but it is possible that there's something about the particular wood types of these logs that they're cracking on that could be, that's sort of the one thing we haven't yet mapped, is the availability of anvils, because it appears that they're everywhere, but it's very, we need more information about the kind of wood that they're cracking on.
They're using specific stones that you could track the stones.
They're not particularly choosy when they're cracking like crabs and stuff, but at these anvils where they're bringing fruits to the anvils, you have sort of stones that stick around. We go every 3 months, right? And it's the same stones that are there month after month after month. And we see them transporting good stones up the stream beds and stuff. So yeah, there's some evidence both of transport of tools and transport of food. Thank you.